Paris and the SDGs really do define the landscape for better or for worse. And so if you really want to be able to do risk assessment in a whole of governance and strategic and forward-looking way, it requires a combination of institutional reform and political leadership. How do Paris and the SDGs converge to create a landscape in which we have to try to create that political leadership and engage those questions of institutional reform? So one of those books, which I published just last year, was called An Unfinished Foundation, the United Nations and Global Environmental Governance. And the elevator speech argument in that book was that if you look at the mandate, the charter of the United Nations and the mandate of the UN, there's a very clear four-part mission for the organization: peace, development, human rights, and international law. If you look at the history of environmental initiatives in the UN, you see that the UN really only stands on two of its four legs. There's a lot of work on development, there's a lot of work on international law. Until recently, there's been very little on peace and conflict and the environmental linkages, and also very little on the environment as a human, the right to enjoy a quality environment as a human right. And the argument in the book is essentially, part of the book is about how did it get to be that way, and what are the problems with trying to do 21st century global environmental governance when you're only standing on two of those four legs. But part of the book also is why it's so important to have conflict-sensitive, peace-building, and rights-based approaches. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the context of a couple of specific institutional settings. The first is the Security Council. And the question of climate change and international peace and security has been bubbling up in the Security Council for almost a decade now. The British did a one-day thematic session in 2007. The Germans followed that up with a one-day thematic session in 2011. There have been two so-called ARIA formula, which are basically informal outside of chambers sessions on it as well in the last couple of years. It's been highly contentious. I would say up until now, it's mainly been a question of when the UNFCCC goes down, the Security Council conversation goes up, and it's mainly been driven by people with a sense of urgency about climate, trying to do some agenda setting, try to use the kind of media garnering and bully pulpit foundation of the Security Council. It's partly been contentious because there are actors that don't want it to be talked about in the Security Council for a range of different reasons. Some concerned that that conversation would damage the UNFCCC. Some concerns about Security Council politics, is it inclusive, the hierarchy of power, the reform agenda within the Council, and so on and so forth. And so until now, it's mostly been about the politics of agenda setting and issue framing, but I think what I would argue is that it's going to be really important to have a capable and functional Security Council on the questions of climate change and international conflict. But if you look at what an actual operational role for the Security Council might look like around climate change, you very quickly realize that we don't have the Security Council that we need in order to be able to do this in an effective way, in a legitimate way, and in a broadly based way. There are at any one time 15 to 20 peacekeeping missions in the field. All but one of them since the end of the Cold War has been in the field for at least one extreme weather event or natural disaster. And yet the Council really doesn't have the capacity to inform itself in an effective way about the climate change ramifications for its current operations. There's been a lot of talk about early warning and preventive action. There's been resolutions trying to move the Council toward more of a preventive body and linking up information systems so that the kinds of human rights early warning and famine and threat of conflict early warning systems that we sort of have in place sync better with climate information. But of course, the Council is a very reactive body. It's not particularly effective in moving toward preventive action. A lot of talk about environmental refugees. Refugees really move the dial within the Security Council. When you start having impacts of conflict on civilians and large numbers of people moving, whether it fits the international definition of a refugee as somebody who's fleeing for political reasons beyond the borders of their state, or whether it's in the more general category of displaced people who have a very vague status in international law. It is certainly something that garners the Council's attention. It's also something the Council's quite reluctant to engage, prefers to conceptualize the problem in terms of that legal definition of politically and internationally mobile individuals only, and leave it to the UN High Commissioner's Office or the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The small island developing states problem is one that's looming. You're talking about several members of the United Nations that are looking at being essentially states without territory, because many of the Pacific Island atolls will become uninhabitable long before they're underwater, either because of storm vulnerability or threats to water supplies. And that's an issue where we lack a clear space. It would take the World Court 30 years to give us the kinds of judgments that we would need to act on that. And so there's been some talk that that's a space that the Security Council could effectively fill. I was doing some interviews in the Secretary General's office in New York around a project I'm working on the idea of what an operational role for the Security Council might look like. And the response on the small island developing states that we got consistently was, that's a problem for 2050. Well, yeah, it is a problem for 2050, and it illustrates the reactive nature of the Council, the inability to manage information. I think of the sort of time frame that you were talking about, which is somewhere in between the daily crisis briefing and the IPCC scenarios, right? Regional scale, decade long. I mean, that's the information gap that we really, really need to be able to fill. All of this is moving toward the idea, I think, of a climate-related responsibility to protect. The Security Council has, of a fashion, embraced the norm of responsibility to protect, although in a very narrowly limited way, around war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. There was a cyclone in Myanmar, Burma, in 2009, and the French actually tried to mobilize a Security Council resolution invoking the responsibility to protect because the Burmese government had closed the borders and was denying access for several days of the international relief community. And the French got smacked down. It was very clear that the Security Council was not willing to extend the concept of a responsibility to protect, around which it has a very fragile political consensus. And it's important to preserve that consensus. I'm not suggesting we should redefine R2P to be war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and climate change. I mean, that would destroy the fragile consensus that we already have. But some sort of a concept of the international community's responsibility for protection is coming, and it's something that the Council has not been able to deal with. So to me, the Council illustrates a lot of the themes about how we need to bring to bear, you know, concentrated political leadership with a much more capable institution. Rather than running this problem through the existing institution that we have, we need the institution to grow toward the problem that we're increasingly facing. And so some of the ideas that I think make sense in this regard is, when countries stand for election to the Security Council, or when countries indicate that they would like to be a permanent member in a reformed Security Council, they should be challenged to explain what they think the Council's role is on climate change. The Secretary General's Sahel Initiative, which I thought was a very interesting attempt to think in the terms that I was talking about, maybe decade out, regional scale, I think much more of that sort of work, and giving the Council the kind of informational capabilities. I mean, the powerful countries on the Council have their own information systems, and they don't share information very well, and the weak countries on the Council don't have any kind of an institutionalized capacity to manage that sort of information itself. And so that, to me, is a critical challenge. I also think, in terms of political leadership, it would be very interesting to challenge the P5 to take some sort of symbolic action on climate that was avowedly seen as a conflict-managing, peace-building sort of initiative. I'm not sure the politics of that is feasible at the moment, but as we think 2, 3, 4 years out, I think pushing in that direction could be quite interesting. The second thing I'll speak to, and just very briefly, is the Sustainable Development Goals. The Sustainable Development Goals, I think, are a real improvement compared to the Millennium Development Goals, and there's much to be applauded about the both the resulting goals and the process. It was a much more participatory process than the MDGs, which was a small group of people who were desperate to maintain the momentum of the Millennium Summit and thought that articulating some goals would be a good way to focus the international community's attention. The SDGs were a much more participatory process, not perfect, but better. The SDGs have a much more universal character. There's a much more comprehensive approach, not just within the goals, but also between them. I think the idea of leaving no one behind and the idea of reaching those who are furthest behind first, which are sort of implicit in much of the SDG process, are critically important. The big concern I have about the SDGs is the lack of a rights-based approach and the lack of making human rights much more central into that context. And what I would add about the need to combine institutional reform with political leadership, the question is where's the political energy going to come that's going to concentrate that political leadership? And to me, it's people as rights holders in the context of these challenges that really ultimately provides us with the political energy, as opposed to the desired foresight of governments. I think the SDGs were really missed opportunity to infuse a more rights-based approach. Some of the reasons why you'd want to do that, I think rights-based approaches help us to prioritize. If you look at the health goal within the Sustainable Development Goals, there are many people in the health community that wanted that goal to be universal access to health care. Very simple, and then everything flows from that. Instead, universal access is buried down in a mix of about 15 targets with no prioritization among them. So it doesn't concentrate the political leadership, and it doesn't then allow the institutions to grow toward that reformed conception of the problem. And so I think rights-based approaches really help us establish priorities. The second thing is the intersectionality, right? We've got all these goals: food, water, health, education. It's the connective tissue between them that is the real space for synergistic opportunities, where you can invest smaller amounts of money in efficient ways and leverage several goals at once. So the link between the rights of women, the need to haul water, and the lack of access to education is very, very well understood. It's also almost invisible in the way that the SDGs are now written, separating education, health, water, and the rights of women, as it has done. And so human rights bring that intersectionality that I think is critically important. And the third thing that human rights bring is the process rights: people's rights to information, people's rights to participation, people's rights to redress. If you look at Goal 16, which is actually the goal under the broad rubric of peace, one of the targets under Goal 16 is to make sure that people have access to the basic information they need so that they can pursue their rights in the context of the SDG. But it's made subject to the limits of national legislation, and of course there are many countries in the world where people don't enjoy those kinds of information rights, to say nothing about participatory rights or rights of redress. And so again, a missed opportunity to use the symbolic power of human rights to leverage people being able to mobilize around the realization of those rights. And so I think this, in very different ways, I think the rollout of the SDGs and the agenda that's looming for the Security Council illustrate the point that what we really need is not to be running these problems through the institutions that we have, but to be challenging these institutions to sort of grow toward where the problem, in fact, is bringing us. I was going to say a little bit about a third institutional challenge, and that's climate engineering. If you look at what Paris actually did, my take on Paris is that it's great that it brings adaptation into the mix. It's great that it universalizes the problem, as opposed to this kind of north versus south structure of Kyoto and so on. But what Paris essentially did is it sets a very ambitious goal well below 2°C with essentially a voluntary opt-in approach, where countries define their nationally determined commitments. And as you pointed out, the math on that just doesn't add up. Well, one of the really interesting results that may come from that combination of a highly ambitious goal and a lack of traction through basically a voluntary opt-in regime is the idea of climate engineering. And this is something where highly controversial, highly potential to provoke conflict on all sorts of levels. Not necessarily something that's likely to be done by large. There's a lot of, the people who've really kind of made an issue about climate engineering like to talk a lot about the idea that it'll come from powerful corporations or it'll come from hegemonic governments and so on. It seems to me the most likely scenario for somebody trying to do some serious, large-scale interventions in the environment, to promote some sort of mitigative effects, is a large developing country taking action on a regional scale, and that because the ability to do it is not necessarily the limiting factor. And so essentially, what I would say about climate engineering is that it's something with a great deal of potential for unknown risks and unintended consequences. It creates a great deal of moral hazard in the sense that if we start doing that, we might think we're on an easy path and we don't do the hard work that we need to do to deal with the climate problem. It puts us on a treadmill because once you start doing it, especially if you're not doing that other hard work, you can't stop or you're in a worse place than you were before you started. It has tremendous potential to create winners and losers on a regional scale, which is a recipe for conflict. And there's no regulatory framework. And so that, to me, is a case where we really don't have any kind of an institutional setting. And I think it's going to be important to start thinking about creating one now before people who can wield the technology start filling the space, as I think eventually they probably inevitably will.